Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. And I know you are too, because you're tuned in. Today is the latest episode of Tragedy and Hope with my co-host, Richard Grove. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Maria. Thanks for having me back.
My pleasure. You know, it's interesting. I did a little opening intro for Richard Gage. He was in town about 2 weeks ago in Phoenix. And it's amazing to me that people are still talking about Richard Grove and Richard Grove's work. Not that it was Richard Gage talking about it, but I noticed when a lot of people came up to me afterwards, they had questions about other things about 9/11 besides the explosions in the building. And, you know, your name gets bandied about even to this day, and I keep referring people to your excellent work on it.
Well, you know, that seems logical, being as you're responsible, whether it's good or bad, that I'm out there. if people are mentioning my name, it means they're looking outside the box. They're just asking other questions that they also need to have the relevant evidence considered and have valid answers found. And I've always been a big fan of Richard Gage's presentation. I filmed him back in April of 2008, maybe. It was one of the first things that I actually went out and filmed, and it was at MIT. And so that was really the first time I got to see his presentation anywhere else than like clips on the web. And what I found was there was a bunch of, you know, the whole, it was pretty much a sellout room. It wasn't charged, but like the room was full. It was a lecture hall. And so I had a camera down front and I had a camera in the back. And so I'm trying to make sure I've got the footage, but I'm also paying attention to the presentation. And there was this part that was just so striking because at the beginning, he asked about how many people believe, you know, or, you know, understand that 9/11 wasn't as you think it is, right? And nobody raised their hand. And I was like, oh, this is a typical MIT audience. By the end of his presentation, because he was using the scientific method, because he was showing valid evidence that exists, that's, you know, being negated by the official story, that's the fallacy of the neglected aspect, he won over the entire crowd. Like, I have video from the back of the room where no one puts their hands up at the beginning and everyone puts their hands up at the end. And that's not me appealing to their authority. I'm just saying I'd already come to similar realizations. And when a room full of MIT people can go through the same process of realizing, even if it's just in Gage's presentation, Building 7 mostly in the towers, and I was pointing to the corporate connections and the intelligence connections and the money laundering and the stock option trading going on beforehand, these guys are prophets, or they're running a business plan, they're running a con. And so there's not a lot out there on the con angle.
Right. Well, you know, interesting. He had probably 300 people in the audience, and he did the same thing. I would say out of the 300, maybe a dozen said that they believed the official story. So he had a lot of educated people in the audience.
Right.
By the end of his presentation, no one raised their hand. And, you know, the value of what he presents is huge in the way he presents it, because he's very calm. He's not screaming about it. You know, he's showing you the video. I don't know how much he's updated it since when you saw it.
Yeah, there's not a lot of appeal to emotion or fear. It's very scientific. He's an architect. It's an engineering perspective. There's a lot of engineering data and evidence and calculations that you can do yourself and figure out, you know. The speed of gravity is 9.8 meters per second squared, or 32 feet per second squared, and you can figure these things out. Why would a cannonball dropped at the top of the building fall at the same rate of the building when the cannonball doesn't encounter resistance, and all the building encounters is resistance? That's an engineer's job, to provide plenty of resistance so that buildings don't fall down magically.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, what's interesting is, even though a lot of people didn't care for the book, and to me it didn't matter, I had gotten the book, The Ground Truth, which was written by John Fama, the lead counsel on the 9/11 Commission. And I read through probably half of it. When I went to contact his publicist, all of a sudden he wasn't doing interviews. But the interesting thing is, on the cover of the book, and like in the first chapter, he says that from the beginning they knew the official story was a fabrication, and that it tied their hands on the investigation. Now, to me, to talk to somebody outside of, you know, the 9/11 group or people that are aware, to give it credibility, when you can say you need to start with the book the lead counsel on the 9/11 Commission wrote, because he clearly says the official story was a lie and they knew it. That gets people's attention.
Sure.
You know, I don't know what happened to that book or what happened to that author. What I do know is from the time they submitted it to me to when I contacted them probably a couple of weeks later, he was not doing interviews.
Well, it sounds like that he was trying to put the truth out there, and then he got his, you know, his hands wrapped with a ruler, and someone
exactly.
said, that's bad. So I would try to get a handle on that book, because it's very similar to the book that Rene Wurmser, who was the lead counsel for the Rees Committee in the 1950s, investigating the corruption of public education by these big foundations. It's the same thing. So he's got a book as the lead counsel, and he says, here's how this whole thing was corrupted, and here's how these foundations have their fingers and everything. Sounds like the general counsel for the 9/11 Commission has done the same thing, but isn't going to go on a press tour. So you'll have to listen to the Maria Show, find out about Ground Truth. I'm going to get a copy of that just because I'm curious, and I like to collect pieces of evidence by credible people that are presented in a coherent way. And I think that's the real difference between the 9/11 Truth community is the community that has reviewed data outside of the mainstream media and seen a more convincing story, that which is reflective of a reality, than what they had before. So they've done a simple comparison and contrast. And what I find, by a large degree, is the people who believe the official myth, they haven't looked at anything else. Because if you actually compare the official myth to some other pieces of media that are, you know, actually looking at these things with a critical eye and not through a multi-billion-dollar corporation with PR and stock and all this other interests, right? You know, use something to compare and contrast. And so I find the majority of people who hold what are kind of naive positions, it's because they have not looked outside of what has been presented in front of them. And because they have something presented in front of them, they think, oh, this is knowledge. Well, it's that counterfeit knowledge that's actually preventing you from observing for yourself, identifying what is actually, what's all the relevant data on this topic, whether it's that Kony 2012 movie or what have you. And then organizing it, and that means removing the contradictions, because the truth doesn't have contradictions, and all that lies, you know, in front of you, after you remove and dissolve all these illusions, take out the contradictions, then that's the truth. So it's a process of collecting all the relevant data, making observations, identifying and differentiating what's going on, and then removing the contradictions. And so if you use that method to figure out what's going on in any of these topics, you're going to be better prepared for clear thinking.
Right.
Consistently.
Well, On that Kony 2012, I've got to tell you, I think Dave McGowan and I pretty much covered that well on our show last week. So if you haven't heard it, go in and listen. But be prepared.
I will definitely download that, Send in the Clowns. I saw that you had posted it, and I didn't get a chance to download it. But now that I know it has specific reference to Kony and the debunk.
Oh, yeah. The entire hour was dedicated to it. And, I mean, it's hilarious stuff. I mean, you know, Dave is pretty funny in his sarcasm. But just to expose, you know, the truth to people. You know, when I look at this book and going back to the Ground Truth, a lot of 9/11 people won't even touch it. And, you know, because they say, oh, the rest of his book, you know, it doesn't point to anything or this and that. To me, it doesn't matter what's in the rest of the book. What matters is the fact that he says the official story was crap and they knew it from the get-go.
All right, well, that's an excellent point, because that's like a shortcut to thinking when people are able to dismiss it. And it saves people work, but it's not really saving you work, because you might be missing out on what's going on. So I like to go with what Bill Cooper used to say, and that is, listen to everyone, believe no one, and, you know, make the truth, like, based on valid, objective observations of things that exist, and keep the illusions out of your thinking. Because they're not really useful to survival, and they might be useful to thriving if you're a creative cartoonist for The Simpsons or something. But otherwise, you got to keep it to what actually exists, because that's how con men and other people get to you. They get you to buy into things that don't exist. There's any number of ads in your favorite magazine that probably show you this stuff, right? They prey on people who are going on a stimulus response reaction without actually thinking critically and asking a couple questions. And I think it's kind of like a game. You have to, you know, you're programmed to just respond to all these things. And I like to just say, how many times out of the day can I actually stop myself from that train of reaction and ask some questions, regain my balance, regain my liberty? Because anytime that you're accepting illusions as truth, you're getting off balance. You're giving up your liberty. And so by not thinking between the stimulus and response, that's really how we're controlled as human beings. And what you see is Kony, That says, here's a bunch of counterfeit observations and identification, but the logic is you should spread it everywhere so that they can grow this meme and you know, fight this irreconcilable problem because you're not considering all the relevant data about that structure.
Mm-hmm. Of course. You know, they hit you in your emotional level, and you don't even know it, but you've just been had. You know, a little further on that other book, to me, if the opposition or the credible people out there, you know, the 9/11 Commission people, if they put out anything we can use, we need to use that for credibility. To me, that's just common sense. The average person, you know how many people came up to me afterwards and said, what was the name of that book? And that's important because if you give them a credible source, what's credible to them?
So they can review it themselves. They can look for themselves.
Absolutely.
It's all about, well, I was going to say, it's about not judging the book by its cover. And it's also about, you know, you have to read into what your opposition is putting out. Like on the 9/11 Commission itself, you got Philip Zelikow. And he wrote an article in 1998 for Foreign Affairs, which is a CFR magazine, with John Deutsch. John Deutsch is involved in insider trading on 9/11. Philip Zelikow becomes the executive commissioner of 9/11 committee, you know, to find out the truth. These guys were in cahoots like 3 or 4 years before, saying in the same edition that Osama bin Laden's like this new bad guy. So there you have the basic tenets of 9/11 laid out in 1998 in one of their magazines. But if you don't take the time to actually, a lot of their magazine is BS. Absolutely. I don't accept any of their rhetoric as my own. But Aristotle said it's the mark of an educated mind to be able to consider information without accepting it. And that's what people who would, you know, judge a book by its cover, that's a fallacy. It's called the a priori fallacy because you're doing your reasoning before you do your observation and identification. And I would say that fallacy is used through time, through the past 10,000 years, most consistently to mind control people. And what is mind control or brainwashing? It's just the involuntary adjustment of your attitudes, beliefs, your morals, your ethics, and your actions. That's what schooling does. That's what media propaganda on corporate channels does. That's what all these things. So once you realize that you're, you know, swimming in this, then you can day by day go about weeding out these different, viruses,
right,
or memes that are destructive. Because when patterns of habit have you doing things that are counterintuitive, that are going against your needs of survival, then where did that come from? Is that normal? Is that natural? It's not natural. It must have come in on a meme. It must have come in from your environment, through your media, through things you were exposed to, through the magazines you read, the commercials you watch, radio shows you might listen to that have a bunch of commercials, whatever. But you just have to be aware. It's not that those things are bad. It's just you have to be aware and questioning these things constantly, all day, every day. And it helps to have a systematic method to do that. It makes it very easy and makes it very non-confusing. So.
Right. Well, you know, from my point of view, having done my online show for, you know, 12 years, there's certain patterns that I see and watch. And interestingly, years ago, right after the stolen election, I'm sure you remember when Vince Bugliosi came out with the book on the stolen election. And I had interviewed Bugliosi on that book, and it was an excellent book.
And I heard that interview. It was an excellent interview.
Right. And it's interesting because at the same time, another prominent attorney, you'll recognize the name, Alan Dershowitz, had written also like a 2-inch book on the stolen election. And his publicist had sent it to me. I would say within a month of, you know, scanning over the book, I get back with the publicist and I say, okay, this is a great book. I'd like to interview him. He's not doing interviews.
Right. He doesn't have to.
Now, there's no reason why a publicist will ever send a radio station or a TV station a book except for promotion. Okay? If people send you a book, they expect you're going to read it, review it, or at least interview them on it. But what ended up happening, I followed Dershowitz, and I'm sure you know the name, and it was shortly after he started to come out with some truth in that book, the next thing you know, he's a big shot in the Bush administration. You know, he's a big member of the JBL, you know, obviously a Zionist. And obviously he too had gotten his fingers slapped, and I don't even know if that book is still out there.
Well, and if I might follow up, because Bugliosi, he's an interesting case study because you have to evaluate things on an independent basis. So in this one book, he could be telling you a lot of truth. However, his position long term, when you take his body of work in question, what is his role in our culture as allowed by the authorities, right? Because he's been around since like the 60s or 70s doing this. And what you find is he believes, and he devoutly tells people this, you know, against reason, that Oswald is the lone shooter, and he uses fallacies to dismiss any other pieces of evidence, and he takes off other relevant evidence off the table in order to convolute the story. So that would be the shortcoming of Bugliosi, and knowing that shortcoming, now you can take this other book and read it, and if he's being logical and reasonable, cool, that's good information that you can integrate and use to your betterment. And if not, you know, you've wasted a little bit of time, but maybe it might be useful later in you know, his larger character study, because now you've noticed several cases where he's been irrational.
Absolutely. And just because, you know, somebody can put out something really good and then put out trash, you know, right afterwards. It's called discernment. It doesn't mean, you know, I was reading, somebody had posted something on Facebook this morning about David Icke's work. And she wants to basically totally discount his work for the same reason a lot of people do. Because she can't get into this reptilian thing. She says, you know, she looks at these people as pond scum. So I said to her, well, why throw out the baby with the bathwater? The rest of his work has high merit. Why not, instead of when you see the word reptilians, insert pond scum? Okay.
Well, I mean, he's quite a polarizing personality. I mean, from his get-go and how he originated as a presenter, and then the things he said on the Terry Bowden show, I think that was the show back in the day. First off, you have to just weigh it. He's a messenger, and you have to weigh the message. It doesn't matter about the messenger. So he has some idiosyncrasies. As long as his message proves at some point to be useful to you, and it should be more useful than less useful. So if in an 8-hour lecture, if he mentions reptiles for 20 minutes, then really you only got your 7 hour and 40 minutes money worth. You know what I'm saying? So he has yet, I would say this, if it was me and someone was saying that what I was saying was irrational or unbelievable, I would say I am as of yet still learning. I'm unfinished. So if you have credible evidence and you can present an argument with clear terms, truthful premises, and therefore have a valid argument, I will consider it, and if I see it as the same thing, and that's objective reality, I'll update my position, I'll admit I'm wrong, I'll integrate that into myself, because it's not useful to me to integrate things that aren't real.
Right.
Truth is the reality, and that's the tool that you have to use to get to it, and there's all these other mechanisms built in our world by these corporations and government and religion, etc., that they feed off of us by putting illusions between us and reality. We take the illusion as real. That's a proxy. It gives our power to them. And then they decide how much energy we get back in return. It's not a direct relationship. And there's a lot of entropy in the process. There's a lot of energy lost in that process. And I'm saying, if we're all saying we are feeling inefficient and our battery metaphorically is run down, I would suggest we have a leak. And the way you find the leak is to, you know, put some dye in the water and watch where it goes.
Right. I mean, you know, I put out information on my show, and I'm sure all my listeners don't agree with every single topic or every single thing I say, but they discern what fits for them and what doesn't. And, you know, and I try to tell some of my listeners sometimes when they don't care for a particular guest, you know, they'll say he's this, she's that, whatever. And I'm like, if I had to look for the perfect guest, I'd have nobody on my show. You know, we're all trying to figure things out the best way we can, and it doesn't mean I agree 100% with anybody, and that's my prerogative.
Well, shouldn't it be about, like, almost investigation? You are bringing someone new to your audience, and it's your audience it acts as a supercomputer because you have a bunch of individuals who are individually taking it in, juxtaposing it against their experiences, making their observations, coming to conclusions. And then from that group through your website, couldn't they, you know, correspond with each other and say, hey, look, we found a lot of merit in this. We have a couple questions about this part. Are there primary or secondary references? Or is that a hypothesis that, you know, we've already broken, or is it something we don't yet understand? I mean, that's where so much learning can really take place, but we have to, you know, get in the middle of it and fall down and be willing to take the scrapes and get up, brush ourselves off, keep going, and repeat that process indefinitely until we achieve the results we're seeking, which is to be surrounded by logical, reasonable people who will not count, like, who will not weigh emotions in these issues, when emotions are the very things that the propaganda is using against us in order to build out these illusions, i.e., you know, or e.g., Kony 2012.
Right. Well, you know, the new Richard Grove of the 9/11 movement showed up probably about a year ago. Her name was Judy Wood. Nobody in the 9/11 movement, you know, wanted to know her, read her book. You know, they just continually slammed her, which of course made her book all the more attractive to me. I said, okay, nobody wants to, you know, read this lady's book. Everybody's demonizing her. They're saying she's saying this, that, and the other thing. And I had gotten the book, and I mean, it's a huge book, Richard, and I read the whole thing. And nowhere in there did she say any of the things she was accused of saying, which clued me in that no one's obviously read her book. They're just slamming her work. And she has a lot of unbelievable and valuable information in that book. And yet there are a lot of people, you know, in different 9/11 factions that, you know, don't want to know about her. I actually saw someone, a big name in the field of 9/11, who said, if anybody is friends with Judy Wood, take yourself off my Facebook, which of course made her book all the more enticing to me.
Sure.
And, you know, all I could think back to was, how many people did you send that? I don't remember how many hours that information was. How many people did you send that to? And everybody just discarded and discounted it without ever listening to it. And if it wasn't the fact that you became like world famous after I blasted it on my 24/7 for 2 weeks, they still wouldn't have wanted to know.
Well, and even today, it's, you know, people are emailing every couple of days and saying, well, how could you have been doing this for so long and I didn't know about this? I said, well, where were you getting your information during that time? Because we've been doing what we've been doing, but we've been doing it organically. We haven't had money to put, you know, advertisements and marketing campaigns together. Like, we've just depended on producing quality work and having people who find it to be valuable to share it with their friends and family, and to expand that way. And so there are, you know, most of the people in the audience there, you know, there's
Look,
a lot of
I've
friends
had
and
that
family
same issue. I mean, even right. When I was in front of an audience of 2,500, when I introduced David, when he was in Phoenix, where people will, I would think 2,000 of the 2,500 came up to me afterwards and said, how come we never heard of your show?
Right.
And, you know, who are they listening to? It's correct. And, you know, it's, well, if these other people are alternative media, how come they've never mentioned Maria Heller? You know what I mean?
Because you're a loose cannon, just shooting truth all over the place. They can't have that.
I was told I was a very fair liberal. And I said, I don't label myself. I'm just a thinking person. I label myself as a thinker, not a liberal or conservative or any of the other garbage out there. I think. What can I tell you? Sometimes I think things to death. This morning, I don't know if you got the chance to notice, another 6.0 hit Honshu, Japan. I would say maybe, what, a week or two ago, right on the anniversary of their big one, they had another big one. Japan just keeps getting hammered. You know, everybody's saying the Ring of Fire is alive. Some people now predicting that California is next because they're in it. And of course people postulate, you know, is this man-made, is this HAARP, is this, you know, bombs? I mean, to me, does it really matter? I mean, just look at, you know, you and I before the show, we were talking about freak weather from here to where you are. And all I can think of is, you know, 20 years ago, my teacher said, we're going to enter an age of superstorms, and it's not going to go away. It is the way that the planet is shifting.
Well, the whole universe is shifting, and let's look at the general understanding of what is weather. Weather is change. Weather is air pressure changes, and it's just a very much slower version than what you're hearing right now with your ears. Your ears hear sound, which is sound pressure changes at a high rate, and the weather has high and low pressure areas that change longer, slower over time. So it's really nature's kind of symphony. And what we're noticing is an unusual part in the symphony, and it could be because at so many rotations around the sun, at certain millenniums or whatever, you know, sunspots happened, but it seems like the heat's going up on planets, not just on Earth. It seems like Mars has receding in their ice caps, etc. So first off, if it's natural solar phenomenon or even unnatural, not a whole lot we can do about it. Let's just, you know, move on, continuing to move forward and learning about nature and how we can come into tune with nature and find serenity and satisfaction, right? Because no one's going to come and do our work for us while we're worried about, you know, things we can't control. So that's part of it. And so the other part would be if you're interested in these types of events, and if there might be some anomalies or contradictions, there's a great resource called FukushimaUpdate.com that's run by James Corbett. And he's collected all the, tectonic information, the hurricane or the tsunami, or rather the typhoon information with the tsunami, all that sort of activity that's gone on in the past year in that area. So if you want to compare and contrast the recent events, quakes that are follow-ups almost a year later to the day and a year to the week, a year and a week later, that would be the place that I know to find some valid information and some of the basics to start that comparison and contrast process. But having not done that yet, I don't really have an opinion on whether it was a natural or unnatural event.
Well, it's certainly crazy weather. I mean, you look at the United States, especially the tornadoes, you know, at one given day, they said they counted 200 in the Midwest, 200, which is pretty crazy if you think about it. And my listeners, of course, around the country keep sending me pictures, either it's chemtrails or the tornadoes and this and that. One day it's winter, the next day it's summer, and yeah, everybody's getting a little freaked out.
Well, what you're dealing with every day is the unknown, which can cause confusion and fear and frustration and aggression. And what you're noticing is that the anomalies or the things that are causing the unknowns that are causing all these things are becoming more frequent. And if you've got to worry about the economy and whether or not a tornado is going to hit your house, I would think your stress level is a little bit higher than
right.
It usually has to be.
And so it looks like it. Everybody seems to be going nuts.
Right. So in any given area, if you're experiencing unusual weather, the best thing to do is network with your neighbors so that you can warn each other and keep an eye out. And the other thing you can do is try to take as many other things off your desk as possible. Like if you're worried about certain other things, put some extra work into those things. That'll help to keep your mind from wandering on the fear. And it'll also free up productivity later when you might need to deal with the unknown. So again, it comes back to, you know, if time is one of our most precious resources, because that's the duration by which we measure our lifetimes, right? If we can't and have never been taught how to manage our time, then it's hard to be in integrity and do what we say what we're going to do and do it when we said what we're going to do it. It's hard to build trust. It's hard to feel serene and be productive and get things done. So it really, you have to focus on the priorities. And if you find yourself spending a large amount of your time during a week in activities that aren't productive and don't really help you attain your goals, then you should reassess that and find and identify. Those are habits. You've done that over and over,
right?
And you got into this rut, but you can now identify it.
You
can say, yeah, can you hear me?
Oh, I just heard a big phone. We have a ghost in the machine. Rich, we're going to take a short break. When we get back, let's talk a little bit about some of the notes you sent me, because I think they're really good. I'd like to talk about the keys that you sent me. So we'll keep everybody tantalized with that. We're going to talk about keys when we come back. Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. I'm talking with Richard Grove. We were catching up on each other's shows during the break. And the truth of the matter is, you know, you do what I do, Richard, so you understand the amount of hours that goes into producing 1 hour of radio. And like I said, you know, a lot of times people say, go listen to this person's show, listen to that one. And it's truthfully, I don't have time to listen to my own show, because as soon as I'm done with one show, I'm preparing for my next one. You know, I'm not Oprah. I don't have a team of people doing my research or anything. I'm doing it all myself. By the end of the day, my head's like blown out. Then I say, okay, time for some mindless sitcom so I can just calm my brain down.
there are quite a few subtextual references in 30 Rock, because you mentioned that last time we talked. So I was like, oh, why would Maria check that out? Yeah, there's a ton. Like, I've seen Al Gore do spots for their Green Week twice in just episodes that I've caught. So, you know, I haven't watched that show over years of time. I've watched it since we last talked on the show last month, and I noticed there's a huge. We can make a whole show just talking about the subtext that is embedded within 30 Rockefeller. That's the subtext. Let's start with the title if we're going to do an episode on that. But yeah, this is a digression. Sorry about that.
But you know what? At the same time, it's a very well-written show.
That's why it's such powerful subtext, because it's a well-written show and it's funny. It's getting out to a lot of people who are intellectually unprepared to have self-defense against the ideas they're being exposed to, and therefore they think those are cool ideas.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, you know, I have a very wide range of shows I like to watch, and last night I watched the most recent American Dad, which is a cartoon for grown-ups. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I have not.
But he is, the father is works for the CIA, but they portray him as a bumbling idiot. He's hiding an alien living with them in his house. The alien has the ability to transform into whatever he wants. And he's now stuck with his teenage daughter and a boyfriend living with them because they can't afford to live on their own. So last night's episode was very, very good. Because the father, you know, they live a high life because he's CIA, he's making good money, and he doesn't want the kids living with him anymore. And he says, why can't you just move out, you bloodsuckers or whatever, right? And she says, because I'm in school full time, and he's working two jobs, but on minimum wage, we can't afford to live anywhere else. So he says, well, how much is your minimum wage? And the kid says, well, I take home $938 a month. So the father says, well, I'm going to prove to you that you can live off on your own for that $938 a month, and tells the mother, we're moving out for the next month. We're going to live on that.
Nice experiment.
And then they show the reality of living on that $938 a month.
Yeah.
And here you got this father who's this big, bulky, you know, CIA guy. And, you know, he's all stabbed, but, you know, he gets into such terrible situations. They find they can't rent anything except in dangerous crackhead neighborhoods. He can't get a job. People look down at him because his clothes are dirty. You can't afford to wash them. He ends up getting stabbed. All this crap happens to him. And then when he finally comes home to his family, he tells his kids, you kids can stay here for however long as you have to, because he saw the horror of living on minimum wage. And I said, wow, okay, the show is always very cute, but what an important message. And that's a half-hour show. And it's almost as popular. It's actually done by the same kids that put Family Guy out.
Right on.
And Family Guy takes on a lot of issues in, you know, very, very rude and very funny ways. It's actually my favorite show. But to watch this cartoon last night and see the reality, you know, there's so many messages coming through different shows, you know, like this new one with Kiefer, what's his name? Sutherland, is that his name? Kiefer Sutherland.
Sure.
A new show called Touch. Now, the premise of this is he has a boy who's autistic, and I think the kid's like 11 or something. He only communicates in numbers. And when the father finally understands the number, what this kid is into is beyond the Fibonacci series. He's into, you know, all the top scientific things. How everybody's connected, all events are connected. I think the show is too above most people's heads to get, but it's a fabulous idea. So there are always some kind of shows coming through with knowledge or, you know, really making a statement on social issues. I just don't know, you know, with what is there? There's thousands of shows out there, whether people even find those shows. But, you know, shows like, well, Touch, they advertise crazy out of. It's only like two shows so far. But like American Dad, everybody watches that. My grandchildren told me about Family Guy and American Dad, or I never would have known it existed. But, you know, even though they give us a lot of mind programming, and I did see that one with Al Gore, by the way. I was like, oh, look at this crap. But there are also programs that are giving us good information and taking on social issues, but unfortunately they're cartoons.
Well, television's a tool, and a knife is a tool. So, you know, you got to be careful. You can use it as a tool, and sometimes it can be used as a weapon against you. So I use TV sparingly because what I did was I compared the use of my time. And so if I spend my whole evening watching TV years ago, I was, what am I getting? At the end of the day, you know, I get sleepy. I go to bed and I get up, right? I'm not really getting a whole, I got some laughs maybe. Okay. But then once I discovered podcasts and started finding podcasts and shows like yours of substance, then I started reprioritizing huge amounts of my time where, you know, honestly, let's say in the 90s, I lived with my TV on like 24 hours a day. I would like leave it on. So when I came home, you know, and so I think that's like normal culture. People like go to sleep, they wake up with the TV, they go to sleep with TV. I've cut myself down to, you know, sparingly using TV when I want to sit and chill and watch something I can still learn from, but it's not full on lecture learning. But right. The rest of my time, podcasts that are laying out substantial information that is relevant to my surviving and thriving, I can't get enough of that. And so I work those in all day while I'm doing work or even while I'm reading sometimes. I can do, you know, I can multitask. And so what I found is the most remarkable changes have come from identifying the activities that weren't delivering. Those are like liabilities, and changing those activities into assets, things that I could use to be productive and build and not only get to know myself and understand my environment, but figure out how to communicate that cogently to others while doing so, so that it's not, I'm not continually creating a knowledge gap between people.
Right. Well, just so my listeners know, this doesn't mean I have TV. When I refer to that, this is, I'm talking about Hulu or Netflix. But for me, Richard, and you know, because you know me so well after all these years, after reading, you know, I go to the gym and I'm reading. You know, right now I'm reading David Icke's latest book, which is fabulous, Remember Who You Are. I read that at the gym while I'm training, okay? I have different books around my house that I read depending on where my body falls.
Exactly, because you can remember things better. If you have certain reading spots for certain types of books, you can definitely, I found that my recall, even if, you know, you can move it into audiobooks, and when you do certain activities, like when I mow grass, I listen to certain audiobooks, I can recall where I was, you know, pushing the lawnmower when Marcus Aurelius in meditation said this, right? So right. I think it's fantastic not just to read in one place, but to read all over the place. I think it's something that is being used against you all day. They use signs and all these other things to control your thinking. We should be doing equal to free our thinking if we want to, you know, maintain freedom.
My car looks like a library. So we don't even want to go there. But for me, at the end of the day, my day usually doesn't end until 10 or 11 o'clock at night. You know, I'm ready to watch an hour's worth of cartoons or something mindless to calm my brain down from learning all day long.
It's the downshift. It's where, you know, you've been going in sixth gear all day, and now you got to downshift so that you can get a good night's sleep and do it again the next day. And if you don't do that, you're going to burn yourself out. So it's just about learning how to use your transmission and how to shift your mind out of first, up through your gears during the day, and back down at night. And that's, then you don't have to take prescription drugs to go to sleep and to stay awake.
Right, absolutely. Believe me, by the time my head hits the pillow, I'm long gone. You sent me some notes that I really like. I mentioned it before the break, the keys, but I left out the keys of self-confidence and self-esteem. These are two things that are really lacking in society. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because society and authority thrives off of you not feeling all that you are. And as soon as they can take you and make you feel like you're less than you actually are, that creates an illusion, and they use that illusion to connect through your, you know, from your mind to your pocketbook. And they found in the early 1900s that it's an effective measure, and all the advertising changed around it. Instead of saying, here's my product, here's why you need it, here's why it's, you know, it has integrity, it now goes to see the pretty girl, buy the car.
Right. Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. Many years ago, Cosmopolitan magazine had put out this big contest or poll or whatever the hell it was, asking people, what do you think is the number one aphrodisiac to the opposite sex? And she asked it in the survey of men and women. And interestingly enough, the answer ended up being self-confidence. And yet, even with studies done on that, most people don't have any self-confidence and very low self-esteem.
Well, and they tricked everyone into thinking that you could somehow purchase self-esteem and self-confidence. And what you find is every piece of corporate media that's being precipitated on us daily is based on you not feeling good enough. And therefore, what you need to fix that is this outside thing, which is being advertised to you. And that's what's going to fill you up inside. And it's a migration of the American dream. This is what John Taylor Gatto talks about in The Ultimate History Lesson. He says, you know, the American dream used to be based on freedom and liberty and independence and self-reliance. And that's how you had self-esteem. And today it's on money. And I would observe that, you know, we've been conditioned and indoctrinated into collecting possessions and thinking that that is happiness or satisfaction. And really, it's just happiness for the person you're buying the Ferrari from. Hey, we marked that car up $200,000. You're like, who's happy, right? You got the thing that you're stuck with that just depreciated all this money, right? So like the dreams that they put out there through Hollywood and the media and the people that they make look cool on TV because they're rich and successful, right?
Right.
That's the illusion I discovered years ago. It's like I attained those things and I found out I was the sucker. And that's not cool. And you don't want anyone to feel like that. So you really just want to redirect the focus to what exists, and what exists is
literally the word possession. You know, you end up getting possessed by your
possession. Sure, but we've had the freedom bred out of us, and possessions create this effect for the corporation at your cost. When if you learn how to be productive, whether it's growing food on your land or it's raising a family or just, you know, if you work with some friends doing that job well, whatever it might be, however you can be productive in your life to meet your goals, you should be taking steps in that direction. And what they've done with TV and all these other mass media is they figured out how to keep you from being productive. And if you are kept from being productive, then the inventive nature of America goes down and then the jobs go down. And if we are lacking jobs, we need more curiosity and invention. And you couple that with sales and you can hire people because now you have employment. That's the formula. And so if that's broken in our country, when you go back and look at it, again, this is something that Gatto talks about in The Ultimate History Lesson. It's the fact that we've been bred into these situations where we're completely like supported by all these artificial structures that are just there to control us. The history of mankind is the elite perfecting crowd control. That's what you see over the past 2,000 years of written history. The elite managerial class perfecting crowd control. And how do they do that? They get large numbers of people to believe things that aren't true. They spend an immense amount of money to make us believe things that aren't true. You know why? Because the truth is so simple. They have to spend a lot of money to make us believe otherwise. But they do that. They do it consistently. They do it methodically. They do it in a very organized manner. And we are all left unorganized and unaware that we are surrounded by this from day one when we're brought in by our parents, when we're circumcised, when we're brought into the church and given confirmation or all these different rituals that are done. That's not your volition. Why don't you wait till a child's old enough and figure these things out? Let him or her have their own, you know, choice in the matter. Why is it so important to indoctrinate people into things that are artificial when what you're doing is logical and reasonable? It would still be logical and reasonable when the child is old enough to choose for him or herself. And so I think it's the involuntary nature of our society, not just government, not just religion, but even how parents like interact with their children. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we can all like learn from day to day, every day, and study the situation around us, because that's where real self-esteem and self-confidence comes from. It comes from understanding and being able to participate in reality without fear and confusion and frustration and aggression. And that helps enable other people, because while they're panicking, you can help them learn not to panic anymore, and then spread the word. Because I think it's the chief way that we are controlled and manipulated is by getting us to respond to stimulus without thinking in between.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, we live in an instant world, you know. You want to know something, you know, it reminds me of a joke I read in the doctor's office yesterday in Reader's Digest of all places. Where this kid is going through the basement of his grandma's house, and he comes across a set of encyclopedias. And he says to his grandma, "But what are these?" And she tries to explain it to him, and then she just got so frustrated, she said, "It's Google in a book." I thought that was a very good answer. It's Google in a book. Because I remember when I was a kid, you know, how many times did we have to go to the library to use, you know, encyclopedias for homework or whatever. But at least it taught us how to do our own research.
Right.
What happens when kids today, you know, say they don't have access to Google or a search engine or electricity and they want to learn something? They don't even know where to find it.
They just shut down Encyclopedia Britannica, I think, last week.
Yeah.
And I would say, as a child, like, I had taught myself, I had asked my parents to write out the alphabet. So I had a notebook and I had the alphabet and I was practicing my letters and I learned words. And then I started using the encyclopedia. There was one at my grandmother's and one at my dad's aunt's house. And that's, you know, where babysitting time, that's where I was. They were watching, in my opinion, at age 5 or 6 or, you know, 4, they're watching old people TV. So I couldn't watch TV because it wasn't for me, right? It was like Lawrence Welk and other stuff, right? So
right.
I would think of things that I wanted to learn about and I would look them up in the encyclopedia in the hall, right? And I was there. I look up my fears. Like, I looked up Dracula and I learned all about vampires and poisonous snakes and anything in my environment that I thought could hurt me, because at that time I thought I'd just seen this Dracula movie and I thought that they were real. And so I went to the encyclopedia and it was basically confirming. But metaphorically, yes, there are bloodsuckers in this world who seek to live off of you. And
absolutely.
You know.
And then you grew up and found out that they were real.
And now they make the Twilight series to glamorize the bankers and all these other people who will take away volition. I mean, because that's really the definition of irrationality and evil. It's when someone's violating your free will. Because most people, everyday people, your neighbors, you know, that otherwise we'd all be fighting all the time. So the reason everything's chill, if you live in a neighborhood where everyone gets along, it's because we all recognize, hey, we have things in common and we're not going to be divided and conquered and we live here together. So let's communicate and protect ourselves from the real predators. And that's the people that are trying to divide and conquer. Right. And when you look at the world, it's like, you know, the people that run the government, the actual working groups that from the top down control our government. You know, they fight against each other, but they don't fight against the plan. Right. And so the way that they are able to coherently conduct irrationality and evil as their business, even in that state, they're not eating themselves. They're still dividing and conquering us. When they can no longer divide and conquer us, maybe they're going to, you know, go out of business because they would focus it on each other.
Right.
But I think as long as we're all ignorant to the fact that you're not voting for what you think you're voting for, like the dynamics, it's like the steering wheel is not connected to the wheels. You can turn it all you want. It's not going to determine the direction of the car. And the wheels are getting their instruction from the lobbyists and the big corporations and big pharma. And they're letting you play with the steering wheel still. They're letting you go vote or pick whoever. But don't think that that one person can have the, you know, the causal effect that would actually, you know, take care of the root cause. What I see is the root cause is something so big that it takes all of us as individuals to deal with it ourselves. And once we've all individually, you know, taken care of our own inconsistencies and contradictions, then there is no problem left. But we don't need to be unrealistic. That's like a utopian idea. All we need is like 10% of people, just enough so that irrationality cannot be the majority, where evil cannot be the majority, where the majority isn't using everybody's tax dollars to drop bombs and create the world's biggest military. And the world's biggest employer is the U.S. military.
I'm just
observing that if people understood that it's against your free will to do a lot of the things that you participate in every day, when you have to sign a submission form or fill out some other, you know, census or pay taxes or any of these things that are against your free will that were conducted without your volition, doesn't have your agreement, and yet you're participating every day to put innocent people in jail, because that's the system.
Exactly.
That's how the system gets power.
Well, yeah, and people will, you know, willingly march along like they've been doing at the airports since 9/11 in fear. And it's interesting to me. I was riding in a car with one of my friends the other day, and he wasn't doing anything wrong. He wasn't, you know, speeding or anything like that. The next thing you know, there's a cop car on the side of us, and I could feel his body energy shift. And I said to him, "You're not doing anything wrong. Why are you getting all uptight?"
Because that's a predator.
Absolutely.
You're swimming in the ocean and you see a shark, you know, swim by. You're not doing anything wrong, but that is a predator. And so you have to learn not to panic. So you're both right. You haven't done anything wrong, but the energy shift in the car, that goes on because that's a survival instinct. And it's probably learned, not conditioned, like not genetic, right? It happens from environment and experience. So, you know, it's like this. The predators, the irrational people, whatever you want to call them, let's ask this question. What makes the idea of a psychopath so scary? I would argue that it's because they take away your free will indiscriminately. Is that not the same definition as a predator? That which could take your life away indiscriminately? Oh, you stepped on a rattlesnake, or you stepped near a rattlesnake. You didn't actually hurt it. You didn't inflict it into doing it, but it's bitten you. You're too far from help. Now you're going to die. Like that's, you know, let's avoid those situations. It's unnecessary, right? So the less that we can expose ourselves to those type of irrational situations, like the rattlesnake is not evil. It's an animal. It doesn't have the capacity to reason. And so it's dangerous, but it's not evil. We are walking around with people who look like us, who have the capacity to reason and choose not to because it works better for them. Right.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm just saying, and even that isn't our biggest problem. I would argue that, you know, the state, the myth is terrorism, 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 right? Well, there's 3,000 people killed on 9/11 from the terrorism. And there's 3,000 people who die every day from the cancer. Mm-hmm. And that's every day. So like 12 million people have died since 9/11 from cancer. There's all these companies, these corporations who are professionally like modifying our food, poisoning our air, poisoning our water, all this stuff. But they claim not to have any responsibility. Well, that's a fallacy. That's a negation of cause and effect. That doesn't fly. They are responsible. All individuals are responsible for their actions, including corporations. So when we have these corporations who are poisoning us and we have been conditioned to pay them to poison us, we first have to see that for what it is and then step away from our conditioning, change our habits, and stop empowering that which is enslaving us the best you can. And you have to wean off it. I'm not suggesting anyone do anything drastic and quit your job today. You need to come up with an alternative plan that is your plan, that is your free will enacted. And when you do that and you're producing toward that, you won't have time to be stupefied by, you know, all the corporate propagandizing media that wants to tell you to have lower self-esteem because you don't need it. Sell crazy someplace else. You're all stocked up here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, and I like the way you call it, you know, you call the 15,000 hours of schooling counterfeit knowledge. I like that.
Well, because the greatest barrier to knowledge is not ignorance. It's thinking you know already. And that's what kills off your curiosity. And that's exactly what public schooling is designed to do.
Oh, well, absolutely. And for people that might have missed our last interview about John Taylor Gatto's work, by all means, go back in the archives and listen to it. I know a lot of people have certainly bought those DVDs, and, I mean, the response was amazing. I mean, people are really, really loving it. So how does that make you feel, Richard?
Well, it makes me feel good because I had to send you several donations. I think more than 20 people had purchased it, and they got their money's worth because they got $140 worth of value for $55, and the ultimate history lesson alone without the bonus discs is enough that you could study it for the next year every day and go through the primary sources that are referenced and go through the transcript and the bibliography and all the tools with it. And you could get a very, very high quality education. And that is just, you know, that's what we're trying to do. That's a lot of value. And it's for the people who want to mentally engage and the other people who say, oh, well, that's too much, or I can't afford that. Well, then have fun eating out this week or doing whatever you're doing with your money, because everyone that I know has at least a little money coming through. And the people who don't, we offer the film for free. We've put it out in podcast form. So we're not trying to discriminate, but we are trying to encourage people who do have the means to do some smarter things with their habitual money than to go out and support Hollywood's latest film or the Hunger Games had all this money raised this weekend. And it's a movie about eugenics and enslavement. And they're basically telling you what they're setting up for you. And you're dumb enough to fund their plan, in my opinion, unless you're going to that movie to see it as research. If you thought it was entertaining, the joke's on you, and you, I guess you're probably not listening to this show because I don't think many of your listeners.
I never even heard of the movie. I had no idea what it was about.
Biggest opening weekend.
I went to a theater.
It's like the biggest opening weekend. I don't know if it's ever, but it was pretty big.
But, you know, look, I believe in the movie so much that I decided I'm leaving that banner on my website because it's something people need to have.
Well, because it's not a movie for entertainment. It's a movie for your library, for your family, so everyone can be on the same page and understand what you are forcibly being put into a situation to pay for. If you don't pay your taxes, your school taxes, your property taxes, they will send a guy with a gun and arrest you and take away your freedom. Like this, see it for what it is. The only difference between the mafia and the government is the mafia doesn't have a 15,000-hour indoctrination plan to convince you it's not the mafia.
Right. Well, you know, back in the day when I used to know people in the mafia, they had hey, I did grow up in Brooklyn. I am.
Yeah, just, you know, it's good to have someone with your experience to
retort. What they always used to say is the difference between us and politicians is politicians have a license to kill people and no code of ethics.
And what is that? That's the Anglo-American mafia. That's the Anglo-American establishment, where they get guys together, they write it down on paper, and they're like, we can legally kill you now. We can legally detain you. You didn't have to agree on this. No one that is your peer had to agree to this. They just make stuff up, and because they own people in costumes that carry deadly weapons, people are in fear. So my point is, fear is what exists, you know, when you have no rationality, no trained minds being...
weirdness.
I'm just saying that fear is being used to control people and that you need to be able to distill and cut through that fear because it's used to control people to their demise.
Absolutely. Well, Richard, this was a very quick hour. I really enjoyed it. So thank you so much. And I'm sure I will talk with you again next month.
Well, thank you, Maria. Thank you, everyone, for listening and thinking.
Thanks for doing all the hard work you do.
The feeling's likewise. It's mutual.
Thanks, Rich.
Enjoy your day, Maria.
You too.
Peace.